I'm Sheila Cast, sitting in for Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. How can we end the cycle of recidivism? In this hour, we'll talk about two efforts to do just that: conflict mediation and job training. Research by Community Mediation Maryland found that just one session of pre-release conflict resolution between an inmate and their loved ones can reduce recidivism by 10%. We'll meet a husband and wife who went through mediation and find out how it changed their relationship for the better. Plus, an effort to train ex-offenders for green jobs. We'll talk to the director of training for the Baltimore Center for Green Careers about how they turn ex-offenders into qualified job applicants. That's Midday, after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast, sitting in for Dan Rodericks, who's with you every Monday through Friday from noon to 2 on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick, WYPO Ocean City, and streaming live online at WYPR.org. Today we're asking, how can we end the cycle of recidivism? How can we improve the odds that ex-offenders who are re-entering their communities are successful, productive citizens? In this hour, we'll take a look at two efforts to ease the transition process: job training and conflict mediation. People returning home after incarceration face exceptional and daunting challenges. Many have trouble finding housing or employment. They may lack a strong social support system. And even the smallest obstacles, like not having a driver's license, can turn into roadblocks to their ability to build a life outside prison. In 2012, Maryland's Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services reported that more than 2 out of 5 ex-offenders return to prison or are put on probation for new crimes within 3 years of release, 40.5%. Last April, the Baltimore City Council passed Ban the Box legislation. It requires employers to wait to ask about a job candidate's criminal history until after a conditional job offer has been extended. Two studies funded by the National Institute for Justice found that a criminal record reduces the likelihood of a job callback or an offer by approximately 50%. Later this hour, we'll talk to the director of training at Civic Works Baltimore's Center for Green Careers. They train ex-offenders for environmentally friendly jobs and match them with employers. But first, though, we have Lorig Charkoudian, Executive Director of Community Mediation Maryland. Community Mediation Maryland trains volunteer mediators to provide conflict resolution sessions between inmates and their loved ones. All inmates in state facilities can request mediation. Community Mediation's research found that one session between a mediator, incarcerated individual, and their loved ones before the inmate is released can reduce that inmate's likelihood of recidivating by 10%. And each additional session has a benefit of reducing the probability of another conviction by 7%. Welcome to Midday, Lorig Charkoudian. Thanks so much for being here. So start us off by telling us what conflict mediation looks like. What are these sessions?
Sure. Well, the broader picture of the work that we do is that we work on offering mediation services around the state for a range of conflicts. So family conflicts, neighborhood conflicts, interpersonal disputes, everywhere in the state in a lot of different settings. About 7 years ago, we realized that this process that's very effective in all these other contexts could be very helpful in the pre-release context. And so what happens is, as people are preparing for release, a lot of times they have burnt bridges with folks on the outside. So the very people who could be most helpful for them in the transition to the community, the folks who could provide housing for them, the folks who could be there for them through tough times, they've burnt bridges with them over the years of incarceration and reincarceration. And so before people get released, they have a chance to mediate. And in that mediation, they have a chance really to talk about whatever it is they feel like they need to talk about. So often they're talking about the history of the relationship. They're talking about what's happened during the incarceration. Both the person who's been locked up talks about their experiences. The person who's been on the outside talks about what it's been like to have them locked up. And as they talk about this, they have a chance to heal this history and to start thinking about, what do we need to have a concrete plan about before release so that this release can be successful, so that this transition can be the last transition, so the person who's being released can be successful in the community. And the mediators help people have that really hard conversation about the history of the relationship and allow that healing to occur. And then they facilitate a very concrete problem-solving, brainstorming process that lets people think about what are the things that could be barriers and what are the options and what are we going to do? How can we have a concrete plan this time around in this transition?
Back up for me, Laurie Chakoudian. When does this talking start in relation to the inmate's time in behind bars?
It's a great question. So a lot of the creative work that we've had to do working with the Department of Public Safety is really figuring out where in this process is the right time to come in and how to make the logistics work. So at this point, any inmate in Maryland who is 24 months or less to release can request the service. Generally, we go and present on a weekly or monthly basis in the various prisons to everyone who has 12 months to release. So we have a chance to meet with all of these folks and say, as you're thinking about getting released, what relationships are going to be important? How are those relationships doing right now? And would you like this chance to have this conversation before you get out? So generally, we're getting people who are somewhere around 6 to 18 months before they're getting out, and they have a chance to say, yes, I really need to fix my relationship with my child's mother or my mother or my brother who said maybe I could live there, but he's kind of angry from all the things that happened before. Or, you know, whoever it is, sometimes it's their pastor or a former employer. But they get to pick the person because they know more than anyone else could who they need to have those strong relationships with. And then once they select that person, we contact that person and invite them to come into the mediation. So the mediation is actually taking place in the prison before somebody's released. And ideally, people will have...
Let me just interrupt you and ask about what proportion of inmates to whom you make this presentation, give this offer, take you up on it?
About a third to a half of any given group request it. And then now there's some reasons that they may not all end up receiving it. About 20% of them probably actually receive the service of any given group that we present to. But about a third to a half will ask for the service. And then if they don't have – sometimes they don't have good contact information or we can't reach the other person or transportation's a problem or those kinds of things. And come back and talk about some of the transportation strategies we've developed. But there is sort of a broad understanding and recognition and feeling amongst a lot of the incarcerated individuals we speak with that this is something that they really do need assistance with.
So would I be wrong to call this counseling?
Yes.
It's so not counseling.
It's not counseling.
Why not?
Right. Well, so counseling is a really important service, and I'm not a counselor or a therapist, mm-hmm. so I don't want to try to explain what it is that they
do.
No,
I'm not going to ask you.
But what it is that we do is mediators' job is to support people to have a hard conversation, and they use very specific strategies that are non-judgmental, and they are listening to understand, and they're not doing any analysis or pointing out any of their own observations. So they're supporting people to have a conversation that's driven by the participants. And then the second part of it is this very concrete brainstorming problem-solving process that's working towards specific outcomes that people can have as their agreement when they get released.
So what are the issues that tend to come up?
You know, it's really anything. But a lot of the common ones are housing. A lot of times people are talking about housing. They may be talking about a housing plan where the two of them will be living together, or they may be talking about coming up with a housing plan in some other setting. Employment, transportation, addiction recovery. So a lot of times we're working with folks who have struggled with addiction for a very long time. And while they were incarcerated, they may have had a chance to make some progress on their recovery. And so they may choose to use the mediation time to explain to the outside person, to their support person, about their addiction and what they've learned about their addiction, and to talk about strategically, like, this is what I've learned, and so what are we going to do to set up this household so that I can be successful in my recovery. That often is a conversation. A lot of times people will talk about children, their children. And now if it's a father or a mother who has been away from their children for 5 years or 7 years now and only seen them in visiting rooms, and now they're going to come back and try to be a more present parent. There's a lot of planning and thinking that goes into how do we do that in a way that allows, you know, me to be as present as possible to these children and makes this transition work without creating, you know, more chaos for the family. So that's a pretty significant topic. And then communication, that if you consider any relationship that you or I might have, you know, we could always improve our communication. And the same is true for the folks in these mediations, that often they're talking about how do we improve the way that we communicate on an ongoing basis.
And did I understand correctly that this is aiming to an agreement? Is this like a written agreement that, mm-hmm. that the inmate who's getting out and the loved ones he or she has picked actually distill this into a short number of words?
Yeah, that's right. It can be. And it was up to them. Sometimes people come together and they have this conversation and they build understanding and then they feel like that's really what they needed. But yes, if they do develop solutions, then it can be written up and they literally can take it out, signed agreement, and take it home with them.
How successful, in your view, are in the 20% of inmates who actually go through this?
Yeah.
Do you have any way of...
We do.
Seeing how it works?
We do. So we have sort of short-term success measures of like immediately after the mediation and 3 months after people get out, we can call them and find out. But I think really the most important success measure is that this is the recidivism data. And you mentioned it earlier, but if you think about how complicated and difficult this question of recidivism is and how much time and effort goes into trying to figure out how do we break this cycle that's really a huge drain on both public resources, but also it's a huge waste of human potential. And the fact that one mediation, 2-hour session of two people having this conversation can decrease the predicted probability of recidivism by 10% is really incredible. And what it speaks to is the fact that relationships matter, that people need relationships in order to be successful. They also need education, they need job training, they need jobs, transportation, housing, all those other things, but they need relationships. And so this mediation is getting at this piece of the recidivism puzzle that no one else has been able to get at. And so that's the one session is the 10%. And then each additional session, and usually it's the additional sessions where we get into the problem solving, each additional session decreases it by another 7%. So if people get the three sessions that the full three sessions that we shoot for to get folks, then that's a 24% decrease in predicted probability of recidivism for those individuals. So I would say that that's pretty hugely successful, yes.
This is Midday on 88.1 WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass sitting in for Dan Rodericks. I'm talking to Lorig Tarkutian of the Community Mediation Maryland about ways to help ex-offenders be successful once they leave their incarceration. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll have more on conflict mediation and the positive impact it can have on an offender's transition from prison back to his or community. We'll hear from a husband and wife who went through the mediation process. We'll find out how their relationship benefited from it. We'd love to hear from you, listeners. Did you or a loved one struggle with transition from prison? What can you tell us about what it was like? Do you wish you'd had this opportunity? Did you have this opportunity? We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call. And the number I should have in my head, but I don't because I'm sitting in for Dan Rodericks. And I will have it the next time we talk. So please, give us a call. I'm Sheila Cass, sitting in for Dan Rodericks. We'll be back soon. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cass, sitting in for Dan Rodericks. We're talking about how criminal offenders transition from prison back to their home lives today. And you can be part of this conversation. We'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 410-662-8255. 8780, or you can send an email to midday@wypr.org. With me here in Studio A is Lorig Tarkudian. She's Executive Director of Community Mediation Maryland. Community Mediation Maryland provides pre-release counseling. Well, Lorig told me not to call it counseling. It's a mediation session between inmates and the people they love. Also joining us are Damian and Tahalia Goff. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Welcome to you both.
Yes, thanks.
They went through the mediation process before Damian was released from prison. I'm so glad you're here. I really appreciate your being here. Damian, let me start with you. Can you talk about when you first heard about community mediation? Just pull a little closer to the microphone.
Well, when I first heard about it, I was kind of like in like blank because I didn't know what it was about. But when I actually went on my pass and I went to go see the program, lady over the, you know, in charge of the program, she explained to me, you know, what was the purpose of mediation and how it could help, you know, me actually getting back into society. So she asked me if I would like to sign up for it. And I said, sure. So I did. And from there, I contacted my wife and I let her know about the mediation. And we saw it coming up and it was great.
And you were nearing the end of what, a 5-year sentence at the Hagerstown Correctional Facility?
No, I actually had a 10-year sentence.
Ah.
I had a 10-year sentence, and I did like 5 years and a couple weeks. But when I was like about a year prior to my release, because I actually had made parole, that's when they reached out to me with the mediation because I'm getting ready to come back into society. So they gave me a chance to interact back with my family. So we could, you know, discuss housing plans, what I'm going to do with my, you know, families and stuff like that.
Let me pull Tahalia into this conversation. So you'd been living away from him for how many years?
A little over 5 years.
Okay. What went through your mind when you heard, and did you hear about it from Damian, or did you hear about this mediation from someone else?
I heard about it from Damian. And it was quite interesting because he was giving me a preview of exactly what the mediation program deals with. And I found it to be quite interesting because I knew that it was something that would definitely help us upon his release to coming home.
And so how did you guys get started?
Well, they sent me the paper, and I gave my wife the information, and they contacted her, and we set up appointments, and actually came into the facility, and you know, in a little, it's like a family situation.
Where
it was just me and my wife. Sometimes our pastor would be there. And the mediators, you know, no security or anything like that. So we could feel free to express whatever is on our mind. And I was actually relaxed and comfortable doing so. And we actually opened up a lot, you know, and talk about everything.
About what?
What I'm going to do when I get out and my plans. And as far as with family, what I'm going to do. How am I going to be a better parent? How am I going to be a better husband? And we talk about my faith, religion. You know what I'm saying? Actually, what am I going to do as far as, like, changing my life and making that mistake and not to make a mistake like that anymore? And I was even able to reach out and apologize to my wife for the first time since my incarceration because, you know, all these years, it built up within me. But the setting and, you know, the atmosphere was just great, and I was just open.
Tahalia, what were you hoping from the mediation when you decided to take part?
I was hoping to have more open conversations with him, to get things more in the open and to kind of get an idea of, you know, where his mind is as far as, you know, coming home and what his plans were, you know, per se. And just to find out what we can do to work together better than before. And as a result of that, that was exactly what I got from the mediation center. You know, it was exactly what I expected.
Was there a part of it that surprised you?
I would say yes.
What was that?
I didn't think it was going to be so confidential, you know, as far as where we were able to have a better setting. As far as the regular visit, it's just in the open. We can't even sit next to each other. We're basically across from each other, and there's a barrier that is there. Mm-hmm. So we're not able to have any type of contact. And so it is for also my daughter, where she, you know, she wasn't able to touch him, and she was so small that she's not even able to look over the barrier that was there. So with this visit, even though she wasn't able to come, it was more of a contact visit where I was able to express more to him. He was able to answer me, and I could get more of a feel of, you know, the feedback that he was giving me. So it was really, really good. Really good.
Is this a typical session, Lori?
Yeah, well, I think the what's typical about it is, let me just say thank you to both of you for having the courage to share your story with
Absolutely.
The whole world, right? Because you just talked about how the confidentiality is such a key piece of it. So being willing to share it so hopefully others can benefit, really appreciate that. I think the piece that they're highlighting, though, that's really important is that they both have had and have the wisdom that they need, and they both have and had the heart that they need, and they both have and had the courage and the strength. And what the mediation does is it puts them in the same room in this private, confidential setting, and the mediators support all of that to come out, and they support the two of them to connect with it. So they've got what they need, but often because people don't have that space to connect, to apologize, to talk, to hear where the other person's at, because the visits happen in such a chaotic setting, because telephone calls happen in such a chaotic and expensive way, this space to really fully explore and connect is unique and it's special, and it is what lets people work through really hard times. And I don't know what their history was. I didn't mediate the case, but it lets people work through hard stuff and make plans in ways that they just absolutely wouldn't be able to do given the current way that our prisons operate if it weren't for the mediation.
So did you actually, Tahalia and Damian, did you reach agreements on some specific
Yes.
things? Can you tell me what one of them was?
Well, one of my specific was actually when I actually get home, I have to cook.
You have to cook?
I have to cook. And I have to take my little daughter to school, and I have to pick her back up. And those were agreements that we made, and I had to go to church.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And Tahalia, did you commit to something that you might not otherwise have formally committed to?
Yes. We also wanted to have more children. And, you know, on the listing where we stated how many children, you know, we actually have one on the way. So,
well, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. It happened sooner than we thought, but that was one of the listing. But as far as job related, you know, he has been going out there in the field searching for a job, and even to his driver's license, you know, that was one of his plans to come home, getting back his driver's license. So all that is coming into play. It's working out really good. You know, when we look back on the listing, you know, that we came up with, because every week that we go to the mediation service, we come up with different ideas of
things.
Are
you still going? You're using present tense. Are you still going?
No. Okay. In the past. Yeah, but we still...
I appreciate you bringing us into the process. I just wanted to be sure I wasn't missing something.
Yeah, but what I mean right now is that we still have that listing from what we had when we did have the sessions. So when we look back on there, we're actually checking off some things because they're coming to pass. You know, everything that we had on paper, you know, it's, I would say almost every week something is coming through. So I'm really happy that we did get this opportunity to even be a part of the mediation service, you know, because it's working out really good for us. You know, everything that we had planned with our daughter, those things are happening right now. You know, so it's really good. It's really good. The mediation center is Yes. It's awesome.
Damian, I'm so happy to hear about this positive part. What has been the hardest part of getting back into society for you?
Actually,
and you've been out about how long?
Well, 9 days.
Oh,
9 days.
Welcome home.
Thanks. The hardest part is actually finding employment. That's one of my major, because I've tried numbers of application. I went on interviews, still waiting on a phone call. But I actually try to go back to school also. Do try to get a course online to do
study what?
Psychology.
Wow.
Yes, so because I actually want to do counseling, try to see what I could do to help the inner community, troubled kids and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to
mm-hmm.
help reach out. So, but one of my the hardest part for me is actually finding employment.
Listeners, if you want to be part of this conversation, please call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. If you have thoughts about prisoner reentry, if you have some questions about how this community mediation actually works. Lorig, besides this work with offenders who are leaving incarceration, what other kind of work does community mediation do?
Well, there's 18 community mediation centers throughout the state. And they do, many of them are involved in the prisoner reentry work. They also do work in the schools, both conflicts amongst students, truancy issues, mediate attendance mediations. They do work in communities, mediating neighborhood disputes, family disputes, business disputes. Also, custody visitation issues and family court, parenting plan mediations. So, and some large group facilitation, large group community-wide issues.
Tahalia, what advice would you give someone else who's, first of all, considering whether or not to do mediation, and secondly, someone who said, "Yeah, I think I'm going to try that." What should they be wary of, or what should they try to focus on and not focus on?
I would say go for it. You know, if you want to, just right now, a lot of times we're so stuck in doing things the way that we think is working. But with the mediation, services, it opens up your thoughts, give you the opportunity to be able to focus on areas that you may be missing. It's a session where you can get things more in the open between you and your partner and, discuss more about what changes you all can make to better the relationship. And definitely I believe that this mediation service will be of great help to your relationship, just to give you more ideas on what direction to go and just stick into whatever goal you may have in mind.
Damien, is there anything you would want people in your position to be aware of as they go into mediation? Is there a way to make it better or worse?
Well, I would say definitely make it better. Because, as I said, the sessions were great, and as we're very open, and I've learned a lot about my wife also, because she opened up to me also, and I was able to open up to her, and we set so many goals, and put our mind so it was so positive, it was never negative, it was always positive, and I would suggest that. Any inmate that's out there, they need to try to do the mediation because it really helps.
Lorig, you mentioned a few minutes ago that transportation tends to be a big hurdle for people coming back into the community. Tell me more about what you had in mind.
Well, it is. I mean, I think there's actually two things. Transportation is sometimes a topic in the mediation because figuring out how to get to jobs or interviews or those kinds of things. So sometimes that'll actually be something that people will make a plan about together. About how they're going to deal with transportation. The other thing I was referencing, though, is one of our challenges in the program is that the many people who are incarcerated are returning to Baltimore City, but many of the prisons are in the rural parts of the state. And so you may have someone who's locked up in Hagerstown or Westover or Cumberland, and their family member wants to mediate but can't get there. And so we've had to do either they can't get there because they don't have a car, or maybe they can't even afford the shuttles that run from mm-hmm. Baltimore to Hagerstown mm-hmm. and Westover. So we've had to do some creative fundraising to figure out ways to sort of be able to supplement that for families.
And it's really important to be face-to-face.
It is. It is crucial to be face-to-face. I think, and even as Damien and Tahalia were talking about, the difference between the visiting room as opposed to the mediation room, that space being in the same room, there's parts of it that are about verbal communication, parts are about nonverbal, and parts are just about having that feeling that this is safe to talk about anything. And I think they both mentioned that. And that really only comes from having everyone in the same room at the same time. And if I could just give a quick shout out to this department, Maryland's Department of Public Safety, is the only one in the country at this point that has this mediation happening behind bars. And the reason is because many departments are not willing to have mediators and participants and incarcerated individuals in the same room for this conversation without correction staff in the room. Every other agency in the country where they've tried to do this, the department's often said, no, you know, you can't have that private space because of security issues. And it took us a couple years to negotiate with the Department of Public Safety. But ultimately, once we worked through some of the security protocols, they were willing to have us do this. And they have been. And now since 2008, we've been offering it. And it's been growing over the years. And we remain still. Maryland is the only state in the country where this is happening. And I think that Damien and Talia kind of explained even better than I could, why it's so crucial that it's a face-to-face in the same room.
Oh, yeah. Tahalia definitely gave me an understanding of why that's so important. Is it taxpayer-funded, or where do the resources to support this come from?
Well, one really important thing is that the most of the mediations are being done by volunteers. So we have volunteers who have gone through extensive training, 70 hours of training, apprenticeship, and so on, who are so committed to healing relationships and supporting successful reentry that they go in on a regular basis to mediate these cases. The staff time, the Department of Public Safety currently has funds that pay for some of the staff that do case management. And then we also do the additional fundraising. The one that I did recently was I ran from Baltimore to Hagerstown, which is 67 miles. So I did it in a day and a half.
You are a runner.
To raise money for the transportation, because that's the trip that needs to be. So that piece of it. So we do creative fundraising also to supplement some of the public money and the volunteer time that supports the program to happen.
And what kind of training do mediators get?
Well, there's a 50-hour basic mediation training, and it's in, we call it inclusive listening, listening deeply for the feelings, values, and topics, open-ended questions. And those are the strategies that help get to those deeper levels. The training also includes the brainstorming strategies, how to do that. And they talked about the list that they end up with as a result that now they're checking off, which is exciting to hear. Then the advanced training on the reentry mediation goes to specific concepts and issues that might come up in the context of a reentry case. And then there's an apprenticeship. So they work with a more advanced mediator building their skills. And then we have a performance-based certification for the volunteers as well.
We almost need to wrap up this segment, but I do want to hear from Max in Baltimore. Max?
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good, thank you. This is such an interesting show to me. I just moved to Baltimore, and I'd done mediation previously in Allegheny County, which is to the west. It's in western Maryland.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to share my experience. In high school, my county board of education offered training to about 20 or so students. And this was a one-week intensive training over the summer. And shortly after having this training for peer mediation, my school had a racial issue at the school, wherein students were flying the Confederate flag and there were allegations of racial remarks being made on the football field. So the U.S. Department of Justice actually came in, working with the Board of Education, and instituted a spirit program, is what they called it. And we facilitated community leaders and students talking about these issues. And I mean, it was a really eye-opening experience. One such example of this was when I was mediating between a rabbi and a student. And halfway through the mediation session, I guess the student was feeling very angry and that we didn't understand him necessarily, but he shared with us that he had a swastika tattoo, and the dialogue kind of started there about, you know, just understanding beyond yourself the things you say and the symbols that you use can do. So mediation was very successful in that regard in helping bridge that gap. And then in college, I went to Frostburg State University.
Max, I don't mean to cut you off, but I do need to take a break. If you have a question for our panel here, I'd love to pass it on. If not, I need to.
Great! Oh yeah, yeah. So my question was, how can I get involved in Baltimore City? Are there Baltimore City programs?
Okay, let's ask Lorig to address that?
Yes. So you can find all the programs in the state at mdmediation.org. mdmediation.org is our website. You can click and see all the programs in the state. The Baltimore City Program website is communitymediation.org. The Baltimore City phone number is 410-467-9165.
410-467-9165.
Mm-hmm. And one other resource is the Reentry Mediation website, which is re-entrymediation.org.
And we will – it's hard to catch all that over the air, but we will put those contact – that contact information at the Midday website, WIPR.org/midday. So, Max, I appreciate your call, and I really want to thank Damien and Tahalia for sharing your experience with us. And I wish you all the best,
thank you.
Especially with the new baby. And Lori Charkoudian, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you so much. We'll take a quick break here. When we come back, another challenge offenders face when released from prison is, as Damien mentioned, finding a job. We'll talk to Giselle Fundalis, Director of Training for Civic Works Baltimore Center for Green Careers, about their efforts to train people with criminal records for environmentally friendly jobs. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast, sitting in for Dan Rodericks. Returning to the community after being incarcerated, as we've been discussing, is exceedingly difficult. Jobs are hard to find in general, and much more so when you have a criminal record. Joining me now is Giselle Fundalis. Giselle is Director of Training and Production for Civic Works Baltimore Center for Green Careers. The program provides job training in careers like energy retrofitting, and they work with their participants to match them to other needed services like food and housing assistance. Well, welcome to Midday, Giselle.
Thank you so much, Sheila, for having me.
So talk about Civic Works' mission.
Sure. So Civic Works was created back in 1993 with a focus on serving the Baltimore community through community service, skills development, and, of course, the job training components. We have been training in the brownfields industry for more than a decade now, and as a result of that, we have trained over 500 individuals in Baltimore. The Baltimore Center for Green Careers has and was created back in 2010 to house the two career pathways that are actually offered at the center. The first program that is offered there is the program called Brownfields Remediation.
It's called?
Brownfields Remediation.
Uh-huh.
It is a six-week training program where individuals are trained and certified to work within the brownfields and construction industry. The other program is that we offer is the Energy Retrofit Program, which is a three-month training program where individuals are also certified to work in the home performance industry.
So tell me in particular the training that you can offer to ex-offenders. I mean, are these jobs particularly suited? We hear about some of the problems that ex-offenders have getting employers to sort of take their application seriously. Does that work better when you're talking about brownfields remediation or energy retrofitting?
Generally, the industry is more acceptable of individuals with a criminal with an interaction with the criminal justice system.
We are taking calls here on Midday, talking about prisoner reentry, and we have Lou from. By the way, you can call us at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Lou is calling us from Baltimore with concerns about how much of a barrier to reentry employment is. Lou, what are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are is that. Maryland doesn't compel employers to hire people with prior convictions. Last year, Kurt Anderson tried to field a simple bill in the House to allow for expungement of things as simple as trespassing and public urination, and it was shot down. So people with those simple convictions are closed out from many career tracks. Just because of one simple conviction. We won't even discuss someone who has, say, a felony conviction or multiple convictions. They can't find work at all. One of the people that testified at the hearing for Mr. Anderson's bill was an ex-offender, and he'd retrained after getting out as a certified nurse's assistant and then a geriatric nurse's assistant on his own dime. but he still couldn't find work because none of the hospitals would hire him with his conviction. So the door is closed until Maryland decides to forgive people for their prior convictions and allow them to live amongst us as full citizens. We're going to have people returning to prison because they won't have a choice.
Well, I take your point, Lou, about the difficulty that ex-offenders have. Your opening line was Maryland doesn't compel employers to hire people with a criminal record, and I don't know that very many people would agree with you that employers should be compelled to hire anyone, but certainly the state could work harder to make it likely. Giselle, what do you find employers say about what they're looking for and when they're willing to consider someone with a criminal record?
Sure. So generally, I'd like to actually address that question in two different fronts. The first one is really understanding the person in terms of the totality of the individual. Within the center and certainly within the organization, we look at the criminal offenses as one of the barriers. It is not encompassing all of the individual, the same way that a job seeker that has not had any kind of employment or extensive employment may need additional assistance with resume, the same way that someone who has had interaction within mental health or needs additional mental health should get that addressed. But in terms of the stigma that is attached to the terminology ex-offenders, that's only one of the barriers. And it does not encompass the individual. From the employer side, we've been able to maintain our placement rate at 85% consistently since.
And let me just interrupt and ask about what proportion of the folks you train are ex-offenders?
I would say more than 90%.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you are able to place like 5 out of 6.
Correct. And within that measure, one of the ways that we've been able to do that is to really understand the market and the industry needs. And so the training program is geared towards addressing those needs. We are able to provide national recognized certifications. We're able to provide industry recognized certifications that's not just recognized within the state of Maryland, but also all across the country. So as a result of that, our graduates have worked in other states such as Pennsylvania and New Jersey and New York. The other side, too, is understanding what the actual employer is looking for. And so with our training program, to get to the size of 20 students per cohort, for instance,
And how long does training last?
For the brownfields remediation, it's 6 weeks. And for the energy retrofit side, it's 3 months.
Uh-huh.
And so within from the employer's perspective, understanding their needs and providing them with a good, qualified, solid candidate is the key of the placement and the connection there. We have we go through a very rigorous screening process to make sure that the candidate that we are placing are the ones who are qualified to do the job. And not only that, but also to be able to maintain the job is an important characteristic that we look for. So in addition to that, we are able to provide them with case management services that some of the previous guests were alluding to earlier. That is a important component, I think, to the actual training program, because they are in need, in addition to the job opportunities, they also are in need there's a need to address the other barriers that is associated with criminal offenses or with the individual in general.
That's Giselle. I don't have your name in front of me, Giselle, and I'm not going to get it right. Findalas.
Yes.
Giselle Findalas, Director of Training and Production for CivicWorks Baltimore Center for Green Careers, here on Midday on WYPR. And we'd like you to be part of this conversation, too. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. GreenWorks trains for careers in green careers like energy retrofitting or brownfields remediation. What do employers say when you approach them, Giselle? What kind of reaction do you get? Is it a sell, a hard sell sometimes?
It is not. It is not, because we work with the employers. I mean, we work with our employers not just when it comes to hiring needs, but really getting them involved in the decision-making process. And so what I mean by that is we have employers as part of our instructor pool. Employers will offer their time and services to teach our participants in the program. They'll take a day or two to provide that instruction. The other component too is that one of the things that I've heard is, since working with our training program, I have one employer that I had spoken with recently, since working with our program, his turnover rate has decreased significantly. Since working with our program, he has not had any turnover. And that's an important component, because essentially you're looking at someone, the totality, as I mentioned before, of the individual, meaning the criminology aspect of it, or the interaction with the criminal justice system, is only a barrier, but is not one that cannot be addressed and remediated. So I think that that's an important piece.
I'm struck by that point. If I'm understanding the implications of what you just said, once one of these folks who has spent time in prison trains with you and gets a job, they stick with it.
Correct.
They tend not to move on. Is that, do you think, in part because it has been so hard to find a job? I mean, I guess what I'm really trying to ask is, do the ex-offenders who come to you for training, what has their experience been, aside from the time they've spent behind bars? What other experience are they bringing when they decide to train with you?
Sure. In often cases, these individuals who are coming out from behind the fence have already gone through some sort of training program behind the fence. And so when they do come out, however, those certifications is not valuable per se, because no one wants to hire them because they have been labeled as ex-offenders or whatever stigma is associated with that. So throughout the training program, I think from the individualistic perspective, that particular individual or program graduate is really interested in making sure that it does work, because they're determined to succeed. The only thing that they're asking for is that opportunity for someone to actually give them a chance. And the training program for us is a means to help them get through that process. But they're the ones who are walking through the process. They're the ones who is on the bus stop at 4:30 in the morning and making sure that they're there at 6 in the morning at work. So it's their experience.
Let me pull Tom from Baltimore into this conversation. Tom?
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I actually managed to get myself a good job after a felony conviction, but I had to lie on my application.
You lied on your application?
You've got to. There's no way you're going to get a decent job without lying on your application.
So you're convinced that you would not have gotten a call back and a second interview and actually you wouldn't have gotten in the process.
I know for a fact I was led probably once every 2 weeks off the job site. I've got a computer degree, but I was led off by security once they found out I had a criminal background. I mean, it happened to me about 8 times. It was kind of depressing, but in the end, someone fouled up. I ended up with a job. You know, it's the only way it worked.
We're getting very short of time. Let me pull Kevin from Baltimore in here to hear your experience. Kevin, you also are a convicted felon?
Yes, I'm a convicted felon twice, and I do agree that education is key. My experience was I went through training in the healthcare field, and part of the training, you had to do like an internship. And I remember them telling us that we would like on a 3-month interview. And so I did such a good job in the training, they became interested in hiring me. And so I had to let them know that I had a record. And I did such a good job. They set me up to talk with the director.
Kevin, I appreciate your calling. I'm going to throw it back to Giselle, for we have just 30 seconds left. What do you make of these two calls from two men, each with a record?
Sure. I think, again, just looking at the individual as the individual and not labeling them as one or the other, and really understanding one's potential and using the means that are available to us to make sure that they're successful.
Thank you, Giselle. Giselle Fundalis, Director of Training and Production for Civic Works Baltimore Center for Green Careers. I'm grateful to everybody who called. This is Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass sitting in for Dan Rodericks. Stay with us.